I'm David Dennison and Julie down here in front. We want to first of all give you our credentials a little bit so you know from where we speak, from what area of the world we have lived and worked in. And so what we give to you tonight will make some kind of sense, at least out of the fibers of where we've lived and worked. We were missionaries, you might say, not really, but we were missionaries in Zimbabwe. That is, I went there, Julie and I went there during my internship at the seminary, and we were there for 2 years. And in that experience, we experienced the situation in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia then, and we also experienced the situation in South Africa to a limited extent via a journey to that country. Also, right after that, we came back and studied at the seminary and went out to Cameroon for 5 years. So we have had a total of about roughly 7 years in Africa. And what makes that a little bit unique, I suppose, not unique, there's nobody else like that, but experiencing Zimbabwe in a tremendous struggle that they were in, really white supremacy type government, and then going into Cameroon, which was a black ruled government since 1960, made really quite a contrast and quite an education for us at that time. And a little, maybe just a little bit about our mission philosophy, how it changed from one country to the next. We were brand new and very young in Zimbabwe, impressionable. But one of the most lasting impressions was given to us by a doctor, the first doctor in the Lutheran Church who had studied in America, came out, Dr. Zhou, his name was, came out from America right out to our mission station almost and sat in our living room one day and told us how missionaries should be. He was very radical, you might say. And he said, how can you bring the gospel to us driving these big cars and living in these big homes? Made a big impression on us. We didn't know how much until later. A sideline is that Dr. Zhou was killed, the only doctor in a hospital, a black doctor that is, in a hospital at Manena where our son was born, was killed, taken out one night and shot because he had helped, as a doctor, medical help, some freedom fighters, or guerrillas, according to our newspapers. But going back to study, thinking about what Dr. Zhou had said, going out to Cameroon, we dedicated our mission philosophy to do things a little bit differently. We really had no choice with that kind of directive. So we went out and we struggled in building huts, having huts built for us. We couldn't build them, obviously. And we lived in huts and lived with the people in a village. And it was a Muslim village in the northern part of Cameroon. So just that a little beginning to show you from where we come from. Also, before we get on to Zimbabwe and the main emphasis on for our evening, and that is what we as Christians can do to build Zimbabwe, I want to give you a brief history of world mission. I think that needs to be done to set a stage for why what we're going to say is necessary. The first stage in world mission, I like to call it the dependence stage. Missionaries left 150 years ago to each respective part of the world, Asia, Latin America, Africa, and they took with them all the things that they possessed, that is to say, all the trappings of their culture, their understanding of their God, their theology, their medical technique, medicine, and their way of dress. All their trappings of their culture they took with them. They saw a need and they met it in the way they could. They went out to the parts of the world and they saw people with a need for a certain kind of healing. They had healing powers. They had their own medicines, but they did not have highly technical medicine for specific diseases that, in fact, the Europeans and Americans brought with them and gave them to the people in those countries. So they needed the medicine that the missionaries brought. They saw people with needs for an understanding of a loving God, because most of the people they found had an understanding of a God that was a little bit fearful. They were very much afraid of, and had to build up a whole system around the trees and the rocks, animistic type religion, to protect themselves, you might say, from life, which was very fearsome for them. And so they had a need for the God that the missionaries offered, and so the missionaries met that need. And thirdly, just a little synopsis here, they had need for the clothes that the missionaries brought too. Now, that's debatable, however. They found them in very loose attire, you might say, according to our culture. But it was cold. It gets cold in all around the world, even in Africa, even on the Sahara Desert. So they had need for blankets and things that you send out from your churches to Africa. And so they covered them up. And, well, I say it's debatable because they had really neat clothes. They had a new suit every day, you might say. You know, one day they'd get up early in the morning. It'd have to be early, and they'd go out in the bush to get their leaves. By the end of the day, they retire early because, of course, they're all shriveled up and have to retire early. Next day, you got a brand new set of clothes. So it's debatable whether or not they needed those pieces of clothing from the Western culture. But you can see what happened then, meeting all those needs that they found. Okay, there were real needs, and then some of those are questionable, perhaps, but there were real needs. In meeting those, the missionaries set up a dependent relationship between the people and the missionary, or the church that came from Europe or United States. It's kind of like a situation that is set up between a young child and a parent. So that was the kind of relationship they set up. Not a good one, but the first stage, and perhaps a necessary one. I'm not going to put any kind of wet blanket over that, because it happened, it's all finished, now we have to go from there. The second stage grew out of that, of course, and it happened when the nations themselves were struggling for their independence, political, economic independence, cultural independence, from the colonizers from the north, or from the colonizers from the northern hemisphere. And when the countries themselves screamed and hollered for their independence, their ability to run their own country, elect their own officials, etc., keep their minerals and precious stones in their own hands so they could make some money off them themselves for their people. Well, the churches followed suit. And so that's why Cameroon in 1960, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Cameroon gained their independence, as well as many, many others in the 50s and 60s. And they wanted to have their own church leaders, their own pastors, trained in their own seminaries, their own schools, their own teachers, etc. They wanted to be able to use their own culture to worship God, to beat the drums rather than play an organ that was shipped in from Norway, or Minneapolis, or who knows where in South Dakota. But that, you know, because that was a reality, those things happened. This is what happened. They rebelled a little bit against that, a whole lot, matter of fact, in some cases, and they wanted their independence. They wanted to find out who they were in relationship to the whole church around the world. Now, again, that was a disruptive type of situation, not a real good setup, really. I mean, it was hard, that period in history. Difficult. A lot of missionaries had to come home. They couldn't handle it because it wasn't the traditional way of doing mission. Huh. But a lot of them stayed and worked through and let the young churches, so-called, make some mistakes, pick themselves up again, and go on into mission, building their church. We're kind of in that stage yet. Hopefully, I think we're at the end of that stage, because now I think we're going into a new stage called interdependence, the third stage, interdependence, from independence to interdependence, where the young churches, now called plain churches because they're a church in their every right, have their own pastors, their own schools, etc., when they realized that they do need, and they did need, people from other countries to help them, to give them a new perspective, a continuing perspective from another part of the world on the gospel. When they realized that, of course, missionaries were welcomed and accepted as partners in mission. But that didn't only happen when the Africans or the Asians or Latin Americans realized this. It happened also when the missionaries realized that, yes, they do have something to say about their culture. After all, they can certainly speak the language a whole lot better than missionary can. So they realized, it took the two-way street there, reciprocal realization that they needed one another in the struggle, making and developing and doing mission. So this is kind of the stage, kind of a goal, I look at it as, a goal called interdependence, where we realize that the whole body of Christ is needed to function as the whole body of Christ, not just a couple arms and a couple legs, but the whole body before the church can be the church it's supposed to be. So that's the stage we're working into, the goal we strive for, and I believe the correct one we're looking at today. So we don't send, from the American churches, we don't send, and this is almost across the board, we don't send missionaries out anymore to bring a superior culture or a superior knowledge of the Bible or anything else superior to the people. Rather, we send missionaries out to be partners in mission with the people in the church that is already functioning. All the 14, 15, I forget exactly what it is, churches that we as American Lutheran Church, I can speak for the American Lutheran Church only really, all the 14 or 15 churches that we work in, they are full-fledged churches, and we are partners in mission with those people. No other way can we really work towards interdependence with them. Now, since we are in a period in our culture of what we've heard this week called period of exile, maybe we're not in it totally, but we feel the happenings, we feel that's a direction it's going to go in, that things are changing, values are changing, and when that happens, when we're in a transition, values are bound to change, and they'd better change, or we'd lose our directions. And particularly as Christians, we need to be in there during this transition period, during this exile period, strong in our faith and finding our new values for people in the world, in our United States, in the church, to develop and continue on as his faith, as God's faithful people. Because of that, because of the situation in which we find ourselves, we need missionaries to the United States. No question about it. Mission on six continents has been talked about now. I don't know how many years it's been talked about. Longer than I can remember. But it has not really been realized, I don't think, except for a few official visits from a few official people, from a few official churches to the United States. And generally, they touch the officials in the United States. There's been a few places. Maybe some of you have had the opportunity of having people from other countries, other third world churches in your church, talking to you about the gospel, their understanding. So as they realize that they need missionaries continually in their country, thank God they have realized that, I think. Thank God that we have missionaries who can fit into that interdependent type position or situation. We also have to realize that we need, in this period of exile, transition, in our church, in our American churches, in our American society, we need missionaries here. That is, not that we don't have them in our midst. We're all missionaries. We need people with another point of view, another culture, another understanding of what it means to be a Christian. I think that's really important as we meet this period of exile and transition in our world, the United States church today. So we have, that leads us into our talk, what it's all about tonight. And that's how we can help build up Zimbabwe. At the same time, building up Zimbabwe, looking at what it means to be Christian right here in the United States and possibly having the missionaries come here. So I'll leave it to you, Julie, to develop that project or however you want.
Someone sitting next to me, what is your name? Jean, asked if it would be possible to have a capsule history of Zimbabwe for those who may not understand the historical background of that country. How many of you are familiar with the history of the country of Zimbabwe? A few. Would you enjoy a capsulized history of that country? Okay, I won't go back to the very beginning. I'll simply go back to the beginning of the European presence in Zimbabwe, and that goes back you can't hear? Is this even turned on? I'll speak up. Okay, going back to the beginning, it was about 100 years ago. Actually, the year was 1890, and when Bishop Shiri of Zimbabwe, of the Zimbabwean Lutheran Church, visited us in Portland this fall in November, we took him to PLU, and he noted on a sign there that PLU had started in the year 1890. And he laughed and said, oh, isn't that interesting that PLU began in 1890? That was the year that the British enslaved us, and those were his words. And it's true, that was the year that the British came into that country and began their relationship with the Ndebele and the Shona people there. At the beginning, the Zimbabweans welcomed the British. They were very curious about them. In fact, they thought they were very much like other invaders they had had in the past. They assumed that they would settle down in their country, intermarry, and become part of their culture. They were sadly mistaken. Within a few years, the founder of that country, Cecil John Rhodes, where the name Rhodesia comes from, had indeed established a relationship with the people, but it turned out to be an oppressive relationship. And what happened was that through a series of trickery and lies, and I'm sorry, I must call them that because they turned out to be that way, Lobengula, the chief at that time, sold his country to them. He sold his country for a sack of gold and a boat and some guns, most of which he never received. All the while that this happened, he never understood exactly what he was doing. It's an interesting and strange story and is well documented, but we won't go into the details. Nevertheless, this started the beginning of a relationship between the Zimbabweans and the British, and it has not been a pretty one. So that at the beginning, the Zimbabweans were treated as they were throughout this 100 years, as basically units of labor. So that once the British had power, the Zimbabweans were used to work in their, not factories at first, but work in the fields and also work in the mines that were started right away. Meanwhile, within the Zimbabwean culture began a resistance which continued for that entire 100 years. The word that the Shona people used for this resistance was the word Chimarenga, and it means the struggle. It has a deeper meaning in the Shona language and really means the struggle to right a wrong. The Zimbabweans felt from the beginning that they had been wronged, and this word for their struggle, Chimarenga, symbolized their efforts to right a wrong for 100 years. As I said before, at the beginning they were very welcoming. When they found out that these people had no intention of settling down within their culture, brought another culture with them, and insisted on treating them as units of labor rather than people, they began their resistance. And the first war resistance began in 1896. It was an armed resistance. The Zimbabweans were crushed, and the effective weapon used was dynamite. Most of the Zimbabweans hid in the hills, but they were found and dynamited. The rebellion was crushed ruthlessly. So began a period of accommodation for the Zimbabweans, and one of their tools of accommodation was education. They decided they had to live with the situation, and so many of them became very interested in schools and learning about the Western way. After all, if they couldn't cope with it, they wanted to learn more about it so that they could cope with it, being the realistic people they were. So began a period of intense education and adjustment to the life there. Nevertheless, there was always a thread running through their lives, and that was Chimarenga, the struggle. As the years went by and the Zimbabweans used the knowledge that they acquired, they formed trade unions and they also formed political parties, which were promptly banned. Their leaders were imprisoned. This happened basically during the 50s. And in other words, they were not listened to and they were not treated as equals in their struggle to have a relationship with these people. For those who were very much in opposition to the Zimbabweans' choice of armed struggle, people who do oppose this oftentimes do not know the past of these countries. They do not realize that for years, for 50, 60, 75 years, the people begged to be listened by their oppressors, the white government. They begged to be listened to so that they could articulate their needs and articulate the kind of relationship they wanted to have with them, and that is people to people. So that finally in the 1960s, when Robert Mugabe and Joshua Nkomo, the two leaders of the Patriotic Front, were released from prison, again they were not listened to, so they went into exile and formed armed resistance. And most of you are familiar with the war that lasted in Zimbabwe for 7 years during the 1970s and just recently finished in February of this year. The armed struggle brought finally both sides to the bargaining table where they worked out a peace settlement and independence was finally gained for Zimbabwe. We could say that this is the end of Chimarenga then. This is the end of the struggle to right a wrong. But in essence, it's the beginning of a new struggle, and the new struggle in Zimbabwe now is to rebuild the country from the destruction and desolation of the war. And that means both physically and psychologically the people have had a hard time, both sides, and now need to be rebuilt. And so this is basically the a capsulized history of Zimbabwe. And if you have any questions afterward or whatever, I would be happy to answer any questions about that. Tonight we're going to talk about rebuilding Zimbabwe. Of course, the need for rebuilding Zimbabwe is obvious. The war has hurt that country very much physically and also, as I said, emotionally, and they need a lot of help. But there would be some who would ask the question, why Zimbabwe? Why choose Zimbabwe to help when there are other countries who have needs? Whenever we look at any third world country, we see need. We see need for all kinds of things. Why Zimbabwe? A politician has put it this way: Zimbabwe, Southern Africa, South Africa, this area of the world is second to the Mideast as far as importance in the future of the entire world. In other words, it's a very much of a pivot point toward what may happen in this world as far as peace and war is concerned, and that we as Christians need to be involved in that country, need to be involved in that area, because it's so very, very important to the history of the world at this point. One of the basic reasons for being interested in Zimbabwe is that to build up a strong, stable, prosperous Zimbabwe is to reveal to South Africa that majority rule is not necessarily something to be feared. One of the things that was said about Zimbabwe was that after the war, the black people would do to the white people what the white people had done to the black people for 100 years. This did not come to pass. There was a very conciliatory, very forgiving attitude of the new black government toward the whites, and an invitation to stay in that country and rebuild that country as a multiracial society. And to have a multiracial Zimbabwe is to be an example to South Africa that there is hope in change. And this, to me, is a very exciting possibility, and that we can be part of that, I think, is very exciting. And I think we'll show the slides now. This is simply so that you can visualize Zimbabwe. This is Zimbabwe 13 years ago. Zimbabwe does not look like this today. Much of it has been destroyed. However, it gives you an idea of the feel for that country. I put this slide in. It's not a slide. To show you that things are not like this in Zimbabwe anymore. And I wish I could have had some pictures of the destruction, not because I like pictures of the destruction, but I think we need to see those now and see what it's really like. The future of Zimbabwe depends on the work, basically, of the people of Zimbabwe themselves. However, they need all the help they can get. And in the following slides, we'll tell you why in the following program. I put this slide in not because of the falls, but because of the rainbow. Because that, to me, symbolizes the hope that the Zimbabwean people have now. Indeed, their situation has not changed much since the war. They are still poor. They are still suffering. Many families are just learning now the deaths of their children as the refugees come back to their country. They still suffer much. However, now they have hope. They have hope because they have an independent country, and hope is theirs. Oops, sorry about that. And the hope in Zimbabwe basically is in their children. As one freedom fighter once said, our life is not real. We have spent many, many years in very difficult situations. We have spent most of our time in the bush. We have not known a normal family life. We have not known a normal life. But we suffer so that our children will have a future. And these are two of Zimbabwe's future. The future of Zimbabwe is what their articulate leaders have said, a multiracial society where black and white can work together to build a society and a culture where they can live together. This bridge spans the Zambezi River and goes between Zimbabwe and Zambia. Unfortunately, it was bombed during the war so that it's no longer in existence. However, long before the war began, Zambia had nothing to do with Zimbabwe, and it was because of their politics, of course. But this slide is here to show that in order that Zimbabwe can realize, or even partially realize, its hopes and dreams, we need to build bridges between our two cultures, between our two churches. This is an example of building bridges. In September, 2 years ago, the man in the center, Pastor Farai Gambiza, was with us in Port Angeles, Washington at our church for several days. This was our celebration meal. We decided to do it in African style. We sat on rugs. We had bowls of food before us. We had teenagers bring water around to wash our hands first. And then we dipped in the pot together. We took some of the traditional sadza, which is cornmeal made into a very thick mush, and then we had a meat sauce, some flavored with very, very hot pepper, which turned out to be the favorite, surprisingly. And we dipped the sadza into the sauce and enjoyed a wonderful fellowship meal together. Back to the children. Okay, these are not babies, but these are students. And I show these students because they are the crux of our program tonight and our hope for rebuilding Zimbabwe. These are secondary school students. There are many, many in the country, well qualified for further education, well qualified to be leaders of their country, but with no opportunity for education. There's only one university in the entire country for 5 million people. 1,000 students can be admitted to this university. In the past, the majority, of course, have been white, although they have always had an interracial mixture. Now that Zimbabwe is independent, it needs leaders. The church needs leaders. During the war, the Church of Sweden missionaries, most of them left, and left that church with a real need for leadership. Leadership had not been encouraged by the government of Zimbabwe and had not necessarily been encouraged even by the mission. So that when missionaries left, there was an extreme need for leadership. Well-qualified students, but with no opportunity to train for that leadership. And we'll get into more about what that means for us in a few minutes. David's going to introduce the project, but I'd just like to comment on a few things that the Lutheran churches have been doing already to help build Zimbabwe. And when I say Lutheran churches, I mean all of our Lutheran churches who have been involved in the Lutheran World Federation, for example. During the War of Liberation, the Lutheran World Federation was very active in supplying the refugees who had to flee to the neighboring countries with food and medicine in the refugee camps. So we've always been involved in a very personal way with the people there. Now that has continued as the refugees start returning to Zimbabwe. We have pledged aid through the Lutheran World Federation to help those people out. In addition to that, we are involved through the Lutheran World Federation in rebuilding clinics and schools and churches by pledging money to help with that building. So that we are already very much involved in those countries with very physical needs. What can we do to help in that area? Why not write to our representatives in the Lutheran World Federation and our representatives in this country, our Lutheran World Ministries, and just simply say, thank you for helping those people, and we support the way you're spending our money to help these people. That's one thing that we can do. Another thing that we could do as far as Congress is concerned, during the peace talks, the United States pledged $1 billion in aid to Zimbabwe. Right now, they've pared that down to about $30 million, which is a far cry from what we originally promised. And Zimbabwe realizes, and those who are aware of the situation, realize that this is nothing but a drop in the bucket, and that if we do not supply the aid that we have promised, they'll have to go elsewhere to seek it, and that could produce an explosive political situation as they seek aid from other countries, perhaps Russia and China. So it's in our best interest to help these people by fulfilling our promises. We can do that by writing to our Congress people and encouraging them to vote for those bills which fulfill our promises to those people. Now David will talk about our project.
Another way we can help, and you can see that they need us as Christian people in the United States. And to go back where I left off, we need them to come here as well. Also, for us to help the situation, we've been talking about peace in the last couple nights in the forums. And if we as Christians take this seriously, to that we can be peacemakers in the world, one thing we can do in Southern Africa is to help alleviate some of the tension in that area, in that very important area, as Julie pointed out. We are going to present to you a project that has come from Zimbabwean pastors. One in particular, the one you saw in the photo several times, Pastor Farai Gambiza, who now happens to be, been studying in America for 3 years,